Those others who have gone before and who have made this possible. Admiration, too, for the bravery and the fortitude of their families who have been unable to do more than stand by and watch and who must be feeling a tremendous sense of pride at this moment. And now, I think, our greatest feeling of all is our prayers for the safe return of these three very great men.
Prime Minister Harold Wilson of Great Britain. This program is originating in Washington. We will return to our live Voice of America coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
Possibly within the hour, the first man will set foot on the moon. If all goes as planned, Apollo 11 Commander Neil Armstrong will open the hatch of the lunar lander, which is now on the moon, descend a ladder, and step out in the Sea of Tranquility. About 20 minutes later, he will be followed by astronaut Edwin Aldrin. Millions of people will be able to observe the event via television from the moon. Here in Washington, President Nixon has described the moon landing as the greatest moment of our time, and the president predicted that the success of the moon venture will bring the people of the world closer together. Britain's Jodrell Bank Observatory says the unmanned Soviet moon probe Luna 15 dropped into an orbit as low as 16 kilometers from the moon. The Soviet Union informed U.S. astronaut Frank Borman of the change in Luna 15's orbit. Sunday was one of the heaviest fighting days in the Middle East in recent weeks, but Israel has reported that the ground action in the Suez Canal area tapered off late Sunday. In the air, Egypt said it downed 17 Israeli jets. Israel admitted losing two planes and said five Egyptian planes were downed. Man's first landing on the moon was followed via television and radio by an estimated 500 million persons around the world. In London's Trafalgar Square, one woman expressed the feelings of most of the world when she said, "Thank God they've made it." That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is Jack Moyles reporting.
This is the Voice of America. Our program is originating live and direct from our studios in Washington, as well as reports from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. And hopefully we shall be able, during the course of the reporting of the flight of Apollo 11, to contact various people in various places throughout the United States for the roles which their firms played in the development of the remarkable craft which carried two American astronauts to a landing on the moon. A landing which put them onto the surface of the moon 4 hours and 15 minutes ago. The astronauts, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, not only are well and healthy, but the work which they are going to do on the surface of the moon has been advanced several hours. Neil Armstrong should leave the lunar module at 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time, step onto the outer platform of the lunar module, look around, no doubt, through his visor on his space helmet, and then begin the slow and probably laborious descent down to the rocky surface of the moon, the first human being ever to stand on another planet. The Voice of America's reports will be complete throughout the entire period of the flight of Apollo 11. We have with us in our studio various people from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration who have lent their helping hands and certainly knowledgeable hands to the coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. And we also have a voice which is very well familiar to many VOA listeners, Bill McCrory. Bill, are you prepared to sit behind a microphone and put aside pencil and paper and notes for a moment?
I am now. I wasn't about 2 seconds ago.
That's why I continue to talk for 15 seconds, Bill, to give you a chance to move.
Looking over, some of our briefing and some of our notes on this EVA that is coming up in about 26 minutes from now, which was, as you say, moved ahead by about 5 hours. Actually, I think, like many of our colleagues at NASA and, well, almost everyone in this country, I'm still in a bit of a state of shock and a very pleasant shock at the accomplishments already in this lunar landing flight.
Bill, did you suffer the same experience that one or two of the professional people in one of our domestic television networks suffered at the time that they heard those momentous words, "The eagle has landed," they lost, literally, they lost the power of speech. They couldn't say anything, and they sat there virtually speechless for 2 or 3 minutes. And about all one of these fellows said was, "Boy, oh boy, boy, oh boy." A fellow who makes a profession of words. Did that happen to you?
I think we were all, a number of us were here from NASA and our crew, and we were quite very quiet. And I think there were very few words passed, except thank God, and it's over, they're there, and a difficulty for quite a while to realize that they were actually on the surface, that everything was fine, that history had been made in those few minutes, those 12 minutes of descent.
Well, we have
final
here,
descent.
We have here in the studio two people from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration who are immediately adjacent to microphones, and one fellow who is one of our favorite performers on the flights, beginning, I think, with the Mercury program and throughout the entire Gemini program and now through Apollo. The fellow who is hunkered down off to one side looking at copious reams of notes, of course, is John Hammersmith. His two other NASA colleagues, Bill Land and Don Beatty. What were your reactions at the time that you heard those words, "The eagle has landed"? Don?
Well, of course, it was something that we've all been working for a great long period of time, and not just we at NASA, but many, many thousands of people around the country and throughout the world, for that matter. My own feeling, I think, was that here we have really achieved something now that we've spent a great deal of time and effort in trying to do.
Do you think it's time and effort well worthwhile? That's almost a rhetorical question, a stupid question.
Yes, I certainly feel it is, and I hope that many other people have that same feeling.
Bill?
Well, Al, I think rather than being the end of a program or the end of a portion of the mission, I feel it's really the beginning of interplanetary investigation, a beginning of increasing scientific return that can benefit us all mankind on the Earth.
All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. And now we have a special announcement.
Due to the advance in time for the Apollo 11 walk in space, VOA Russian and French will be carried from 0100 GMT. The following announcement is for all VOA European bases. VOA Russian will be carried from the U.S. on the following feeders: Russian 6020 KC, 9560 KC, and 11800 KC. French 6055 KC, 11790 KC, and 15395 KC. VOA transmitters will operate as follows: Thessaloniki, no change; Rhodes, no change. Munich 1, add 6040 KC antenna 4E/35 Russian. Munich 2, add 6040 KC antenna 11W/58 Russian. Other transmitters have no changes. Tangiers 1, 15315 KC antenna C/44 Russian. Tangiers 6, 17800 KC antenna M/60 Russian. Tangiers 9, 11805 antenna P/61 Russian. Other transmitters no change. Monrovia 3, 7175 KC DR 1/91 French. Monrovia 4, 15130 antenna E2/110 French. Monrovia 5, 9620 antenna CR1/85 French. Monrovia 8, 6180 antenna MR1/14 French. Other transmitters have no changes. VOA English language transmission will remain on the same frequencies and transmitters as previously scheduled.
You're listening to the Voice of America, broadcasting from Washington. We know perhaps it is a bit repetitious, but we will make the assumption that people are joining us throughout the coverage by the VOA of the flight of Apollo 11. But two American astronauts have landed their lunar module safely on the surface of the moon. They have been there now for 4 hours and 22 minutes. They will begin their work, the human work, upon the surface of the moon at 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time. The VOA will continue its live coverage of Apollo 11. In Great Britain, Columbia Broadcasting Systems reporter Maury Schaefer talked with Sir Bernard Lovell, who is the head of the Jodrell Bank Observatory in England, which has an important role in the Apollo 11 mission.
Sir Bernard, just about everybody up here sat with fascination when we heard that cool talk down, but it must have been a very special moment for you, sir.
It was certainly tremendous, and as an ordinary individual, I share the emotions of most other people who listen to these moments of drama. And as a scientist, I feel that a completely new avenue, a revolutionary one, has been opened for our further understanding of the universe. For the Americans, it is a very, very great moment indeed. By this successful landing of two men in this extraordinarily efficient and calm way, they have demonstrated a superiority in a manner which is still exceedingly difficult to comprehend. I think that it is very hard to find words to express one's admiration and one's congratulations to our American colleagues on this really dramatic achievement.
In just 12 years now, Sir Bernard, we've seen such fantastic leaps forward in research in outer space. When do you think scientists like yourself will be able to place a radio telescope of that kind, of that extent?
Well, I think with the engineering and technical achievements which have been demonstrated in this Apollo series, it will not be very long. And after all, these Apollo 11 astronauts are going to leave some scientific instruments on the moon. But for astronomers like myself, the real excitement is just beginning, when we can get replicas of this instrument and optical telescopes. Not only that, but the whole range of the spectrum can be covered without hindrance from the lunar surface. And this is really the drama which is now beginning to unfold for the exploration of space.
That was Sir Bernard Lovell, head of the Jodrell Bank Observatory in England. We have been broadcasting that the BVA, the extravehicular activity of the two American astronauts, would begin at 1 hour GMT. We should like to modify that somewhat. It should begin at approximately 1 hour 32 GMT. The EVA should begin at approximately 1 hour 32 Greenwich Mean Time. In the United States, there's an expression which has been current now for perhaps 2 years or so: don't trust anyone over 30 years of age. Well, this is the slogan of some of the radical young rebels of today. Well, how about those three men of the Apollo spacecraft, Columbia, and the Eagle? Ed Gordon had some thoughts on that subject.
You've been hearing a lot these last few days about trajectories and command modules, the effects of weightlessness, the composition of the lunar surface, and all of it, beyond the dull compilation of statistics, is highly exciting. One fact about the flight that may have escaped fuller attention at this moment of exploration and adventure is the age of the astronauts. Both Neil Armstrong and Michael Collins are 38 years old. Edwin Aldrin is 39. That's a comfort, especially to a reluctant middle-ager such as myself. Sure, many of the support scientists and technicians back at Cape Kennedy and at the Houston Space Center are in their eager and brilliant 20s. After all, space science is a vigorous young science, requiring not only new formulas, but new attitudes also. It takes an open, uncluttered mind to absorb the tremendous body of technology required to send a man to outer space. But the men who make the actual journey, where experience and mature judgment is the criterion, they are all pushing 40. A book popular in America a number of years back was entitled Life Begins at 40, maybe. A saying current today among the youth is, don't trust anyone over 30. Maybe that too. Yet when astronauts Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin return to this planet, they will be indisputable heroes. Heroes to those over 40, heroes to those under 30. Charles Webb is the young author of the book The Graduate and has been taken up as a quiet spokesman for the under 30 generation. In a recent interview with The Voice of America, he said, "I think if we look underneath the headlines, the placards, and the screaming, we see that we are moving forward toward a closer relationship with each other." He was talking about a more humanistic society, one in which the young and the old will make more of an attempt to understand each other's viewpoints and problems, and doing this without either group becoming, as the young people say, uptight in each other's presence, nervous, upset, withdrawn. Certainly, a closer relationship was established between the young scientists on the ground and the older astronauts in space. This simply had to be. It was a basic matter of survival. But the implications are obvious to anybody of any age who is interested in survival, not only in the darkness of space, but in other more mundane but just as vital areas here on Earth. We can expect the parades and the tributes when the three astronauts complete their heroic mission. Children will be building, they already are, models of the lunar module, dreaming of the day when they too will be heading for the stars. High school and college students, no matter how blasé in this age of fabulous exploration, surely will pause a few moments every now and then to think about the three pioneers. Those of us who are older and who have lived through lists of hero after hero still will add the new ones to the book. On the journey to the moon and back, astronauts Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin will have bridged some 750,000 kilometers of space. They also will have managed to bridge the more abstract but just as difficult generation gap. This is Edwin Gordon, VOA, Los Angeles.
We'll have some more comments in just a few moments about the ages and the types of people who are flying the American space vehicle, but right now we would like to report that the Apollo 11 flight has received front page attention in a French communist newspaper. With a report from Paris, here is VOA's John Bew.
The French Communist Party's Sunday publication Humanité Dimanche calls the Apollo moon flight the most extraordinary adventure of the history of mankind. The communist newspaper devotes a six-page spread to the event, including three in color. The front page of this Sunday's issue shows the lunar exploration module on the background of one of the photos of the moon's surface taken by the Apollo 8 crew. Humanité Dimanche's science editor, Robert Le Chêne, outlines what he calls the considerable hazards the Apollo 11 crew will face during the landing and walkout. He notes that the Soviet Union has decided to obtain scientific data on the moon by means of automatic satellites. He attributes the mystery surrounding the Lunar 15 mission to what he calls Soviet astronautics' characteristic discretion, which always refrains from anticipating success, with some exceptions such as Luna 2. A front page title in the communist publication states that Luna 15 has awaited the American spacecraft. But Mr. Le Chêne frankly highlights the advantages of a manned flight to the moon. He notes that the way in which the astronauts' organs react to conditions on the moon should yield valuable information, and writes, "In addition to the formidable victory of man's genius over his own fragility, which the Apollo venture represents, it promises to be especially fascinating from this biological standpoint. While Paris is awaiting its night on the moon, everything is ready at the enormous exhibition hall, the Palace of Discovery in Paris, where thousands of Parisians are able to follow the moon landing both inside the building and outside in the streets on loudspeakers. At the Renault pub on the Champs-Élysées, arrangements have been made to record questions from the audience, which will be answered by a panel of French scientists. The Journal du Dimanche, the only other Sunday newspaper in France, revealed that 10 years ago, Mr. André Spinmetz, a retired engineer chemist, who lives in Normandy, made a $260 down payment to the Cook's Travel Agency for the first vacation trip to the moon at a price then set at $3,200. Mr. Steenmetz, according to the newspaper, is the only Frenchman to have shown such foresight. Looking some years ahead, Mr. Steenmetz told the Journal du Dimanche, I think I've saved money on that trip. This is John Pugh, Voice of America, Paris.
And this is the Voice of America, broadcasting live and direct from Washington, the flight of Apollo 11. Now, a special announcement.
Due to the advance in time for the Apollo 11 walk in space, VOA Russian and French will be carried from 0100 GMT. Now, the following announcement is for all VOA European bases. VOA Russian will be carried from the United States on the following feeders. Russian, 6020 kilocycles, 9560 kilocycles, and 11800 kilocycles. French, 6055 kilocycles, 11790 kilocycles, and 15395 kilocycles. VOA transmitters will operate as follows. Thessaloniki, no change. Rhodes, no change. Munich 1, add 6040 kilocycles, antenna 4E/35, Russian. Munich 2, add 6040 kilocycles, antenna 11W/58, Russian. Other transmitters have no changes. Tangiers 1, 15315 kilocycles, antenna C/44, Russian. Tangiers 6, 17800 kilocycles, antenna M60, Russian. Tangiers 9, 11805 kilocycles, antenna P/61, Russian. Other transmitters, no change. Monrovia 3, 7175 kilocycles, DR1/91, French. Monrovia 4, 15130 kilocycles, antenna E2/110, French. Monrovia 3, 9620 kilocycles, antenna CR1/85, French. Monrovia 8, 6180 kilocycles, antenna MR1/14, French. Other transmitters have no changes. VOA English language transmission will remain on the same frequencies and transmitters as previously scheduled.
This is the Voice of America. Two American astronauts in their lunar module have been resting safely on the surface of the moon for 4 hours and 36 minutes. They will begin their extra-vehicular activity, their work upon the surface of the moon, when command pilot Neil Armstrong will actually step from the craft onto the moon itself at approximately 1 hour 32 GMT. We have with us here in our studio three experts from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Their voices are well known to people worldwide. But before we talk to them, I'd like to read something which science fiction writer H.G. Wells wrote in his book, First Men on the Moon. He said, "Why had we come to the moon? The thing presented itself as a perplexing problem. What is the spirit in man that urges forever to depart from happiness and security, to toil, to place himself in danger, even to risk a reasonable certainty of death?" Those words were published in 1901. Well, John Hammersmith, Don Beatty, Bill Land, what is it which motivates a man to become an astronaut, to do the things which were described so precisely by H.G. Wells 68 years ago? John?
Well, Al, I think that for the astronauts, this is the high point in their profession.
Was that a pun?
It wasn't intended to be, but I'll take credit for it. I think that for people like this, people in a business like this who are flying, whose job is high-performance aircraft and now high-performance spacecraft, that there's always that urge, that ambition to do something better, to do something that's a greater challenge in your profession. And I would guess that is probably the primary motivation of these men.
What about you, Don Beatty? I'd like to remind listeners that it was only some 65 years ago that the first powered flight was made by the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And, of course, at the time that the Wright brothers took off in that thing, they didn't really know if it was going to fly or not. But, of course, the astronauts approached the flight of Apollo 11 with tremendous confidence in their equipment. But still, there is that risk, and it's the risk of a vast unknown, unlike crashing into the sandy dunes of North Carolina.
Well, in my conversations that I've had with the astronauts, I think that they really feel, in every sense of the word, that they are true explorers here. They are doing something that no one has ever done before. I can't imagine that anyone in 1492 standing on the shores of Spain would not have wanted very much to go with Columbus across the ocean the very first time, understanding that he was going to see for the very first time a new land, a new continent. I think that the astronauts, in a similar sense, have all been looking forward to being explorers on a new planet.
Of course, Buzz Aldrin has a PhD, and I suppose that he approaches this thing with really pretty much the scientific bent of mind, doesn't he, Don?
Yes, I think that's very true. Buzz is a very meticulous workman, and I think that is exactly the way he approaches it.
Bill, can you add anything to the observations which have been made by your two NASA colleagues?
It's pretty difficult to add anything to that, Al, but I would say that besides the challenge and the excitement of a mission like this, of all of these spaceflight missions, I think breaking into an unknown area and with the opportunity of returning something of scientific value, of value to human beings, I think this has a great deal to do with the motivation of those people to take these risks.
At the time that President Kennedy made his statement that it was the intention of his administration to provide the resources to land men on the moon by the end of this decade, there were some people, I suppose, pretty much in a worldwide basis, who suggested that this was rhetoric, that this was hyperbole, and that scientifically and technologically, perhaps, this was an impossibility. Now, you fellows have been with NASA for some period of time. Was there any doubt in your mind in, perhaps the past year or year and a half, John, that this was going to come to pass before 1970?
Al, it looked pretty good, actually, a year ago. I would say that if there was doubt in my mind, it was back when President Kennedy made the statement. I think that the technology, we all felt that the technology was in hand or reasonably well in hand. By that I mean things that we didn't have right in hand, we could see our way through. The big question in my mind, I remember quite vividly, I was in the headquarters office at that time in what came to be the Office of Manned Spaceflight, and I can remember wondering at that time how we were going to manage this complex undertaking. I think that this undertaking is as much a triumph of management as it is of technology.
That's an interesting observation. We've been talking in the last few moments to three gentlemen from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. They will continue to represent NASA as the Voice of America continues to report live and direct from Washington and from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. The flight of Apollo 11, the lunar module now resting on the surface of the moon. Our experts from NASA, John Hammersmith, Don Beatty, and Bill Land. This program is originating in Washington.
The Voice of America has a limited supply of color photographs of the three Apollo 11 astronauts. If you would like one of these souvenir photos, write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is The Voice of America. We will return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
President Nixon described the touchdown on the moon as one of the greatest moments of our time. The president added the comment that the last 22 seconds of the descent were for him, like millions of others, the longest he ever lived through. The president said those few seconds seemed like half an hour. The president's reaction was reported by White House News Secretary Ronald Ziegler. The president himself plans to speak directly with astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin during their walk on the moon. The world waited, and then it cheered. Man's first landing on the moon was followed via television and radio by an estimated 500 million persons around the world. Most were in their homes, but many were in such places as London's Trafalgar Square or New York's Rockefeller Center. At the moment of the fact of man on the moon, there were shouts of congratulation. In Trafalgar Square, a witness described the shouts as a massed scream of delight. One woman there expressed the feelings of most of the world when she exclaimed, "Thank God they have made it." Messages of congratulation are streaming into Washington and the Houston Space Center from world leaders and citizens from many countries. Officials broke into applause at the Jodrell Bank Observatory in London, where they had been tracking the spacecraft's progress. The director of the observatory, Sir Bernard Lovell, called the touchdown one of the moments of greatest drama in this history of man. He continued that it opens the most enormous opportunities for future exploration of the universe. Pope Paul praised the American space trio as conquerors of the moon and added that man faces the expanse of endless space and a new destiny. In Chile, people danced in the streets, while in Warsaw, hundreds of Poles outside the American embassy burst into applause. In Japan, the touchdown came early in the morning, but millions of people had stayed awake for the event. Britain's Jodrell Bank Observatory says the unmanned Soviet moon probe Luna 15 dropped into an orbit as low as 16 kilometers from the moon. There is speculation among British scientists that the Soviet craft might either land or carry out reconnaissance on the Apollo mission. An Egyptian official described Sunday's bitter fighting along the Suez Canal as a very serious escalation, and he said the situation is under close study in Cairo. The Egyptian spokesman said the commando attack on the Egyptian island stronghold of Al-Qadra was followed by massive Israeli air raids and artillery firing along the full length of the Suez Canal. And for the first time since the Six-Day War 2 years ago, Egyptian planes attacked Israeli targets on the occupied east bank of the canal. Egypt said 9 Israeli aircraft were shot down, but Israel said it lost only 2 planes. In the commando raid on Al-Qadra, Israel reported the loss of 6 of its soldiers, while Egypt claimed 30 Israelis were killed. The targets of the Israeli attack included missile and artillery bases, and according to the Egyptian spokesman, electric power and oil installations. Israel termed the attack retaliation for continuing artillery action and ceasefire violations blamed on Egypt. A team of mediators from the Organization of American States continued Sunday to verify a ceasefire between the two Central American republics of El Salvador and Honduras. In a dispatch from San Salvador, Reuters news agency said the government of El Salvador refused to withdraw its troops from Honduran territory until it has guarantees that some 300,000 Salvadorans living in Honduras will not be harmed. The dispatch quoted OAS negotiator Jorge Fernandez of Ecuador as saying Honduras had agreed to a plan for OAS officials to supervise the guarantees to Salvadorans in Honduras. That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is Mel Johnston reporting.
This is the Voice of America, reporting live and direct from Washington and the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, the flight and the mission of Apollo 11. Two American astronauts in their lunar module have now been on the surface of the moon for 4 hours and 47 and a half minutes. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed their vehicles safely. They are expected to begin their extravehicular activity, their work upon the surface of the moon, at approximately 1 hour 32 Greenwich Mean Time, in effect, only minutes away. We have a special guest on our program from Washington. Let's go back and do a bit of reminiscing in history, history which is now fractionally over 7 years of age. On February 20th in 1962, a Mercury space vehicle named Friendship 7 completed 3 orbits of the Earth. It carried the first American astronaut into outer space. His name became a household word, Colonel John Glenn. Colonel Glenn is at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. He is standing by on a telephone. Colonel Glenn, it's a true pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm glad to be able to participate and say hello again to so many people all over the world through the Voice of America, and glad to know that they're all able to participate in this whole thing right along with us.
Well, I think the obvious question is, how do you feel about the flight of Apollo 11?
Well, as everyone's been saying over and over again here, it's gone so perfectly that there just hasn't been a serious hitch in the whole program, and of course that portends very well for the future here, too. We're looking forward to getting this successful extravehicular activity where Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong get out on the lunar surface and actually conduct some experiments, and we're hoping very much, of course, that the television camera that they have on board, which the one outside on the LEM will be a black and white TV, so it won't be quite the same as the earlier color pictures that came back, but we're hoping that it will still work okay so that everyone can share in this whole thing right along with us.
Well, what was your reaction when you heard that announcement today? The Eagle has landed. How did you, as a former astronaut, feel?
Well, I think that whole approach to the landing, just that must rank right up with the greatest experiences that man has ever had, obviously. And that final approach where they were coming down and where Buzz Aldrin was calling off the altitudes one after the other, and their drift rate across the lunar surface as they were making the approach for a landing, that just had to be, there just aren't words to describe how we felt on that one, and how everyone that was sharing this all over the world and other nations too felt right along with us, I know.
What did you do at that time?
Well,
did you shout or what?
No, I think along with everyone else here in the center, I was just so intent on what was going on that you didn't really have time to think of anything else except just sort of concentrating on what the fellows were doing up there in the approach for landing.
Well, Colonel Glenn, perhaps you have some personal pangs of regret. If it hadn't been for a fall in a bathroom, it might be that perhaps you would have been one of the astronauts to make that moon landing. Did you think about that at all?
I think we all would like to. I don't think there's anyone that has any real red blood left in him wouldn't like to be on a flight like this, of course. But, you know, there are no regrets or anything like that. I'm just very happy, and I feel very fortunate that I was able to participate in the space program at all, and that say I had been 10 years younger, maybe I wouldn't have been picked for the program at all. So I have no regrets, and it's just it's a tremendous experience, and of course everyone that's had anything to do with the space program is envious of the fellows up there now. They couldn't help but be. I would love to be on the flight, as would everyone else, and all the engineers and technicians and everyone else that's been connected with the program. But this flight has gone to them, and they are doing just an outstanding job, and we're just very happy to be able to share this with people all over the world, because all the people in the program really, really, truly look at it as a program that does represent, more represents mankind than just only a national program here. And we've looked at our program that way right from the early days. And so I know when I have had the opportunity to travel to many different countries and in my travels for the space program and in business, I've been in 34 countries in the last 3 years. And so I've had a chance to meet many, many different people. So I know from firsthand experience the interest that people all over the world have in this program, and one of the beautiful things about it is that there's nothing in it that is secret. We've been able to share this, and this the whole program up to now has really been that of really developing a transportation system and putting it all together and testing it over and over again in stages. And this flight, of course, is the one where the system finally is coming into its own. It's finally being used for the first time as a whole complete transportation system to go into space and really do things. And now we hope we can look forward to using it for many different scientific purposes and experiments and can make these things really flying laboratories so that we maximize the return of information from space. For that's really the purpose of the program is the research and the exploration that goes on that can benefit all mankind. And I think that the space race that gets talked about so much is really of very, very secondary importance. The main thing is that this is the beginning of a big flow of information and knowledge back that can be used by people all over the world, and we have no idea yet what the benefit of this may be. We're just at the starting point, just stepping off, and it's like exploring here on Earth, or it's like conducting research in a laboratory, but no one has any vision right now, really, of what value this will be as new things are discovered and new principles and new experiments. And so that's rather a long-winded speech I didn't really mean to get into here. I'll turn it back to you here for a second, but that's really the status of the program right now.
Well, I think it only illustrates vocally, Colonel Glenn, the fact that you haven't lost your enthusiasm, nor your interest, nor the vitality of your own being in the outer space program, whether it be American or whether it be an international type of program.
Well, you know, I think our man makes progress, if we could be a little philosophical here just for a second, man makes progress only by his own curiosity. And that's true whether it's in the space program or how to develop better teachers or doctors or librarians or farmers or whatever. Man makes his progress by being curious about the unknown and by learning new facts and by then putting them to use. And that's really the purpose of this program. Here we as a nation, for the first time, have been able to mount such a big program in exercising our curiosity about what is up above the atmosphere and what we can discover and how can we control weather here on Earth and how can we do Earth resources programs and what is on the moon and how do cosmic rays react up there above our atmosphere and just a million and one things that we're curious about, and that this curiosity is really what all of man's progress is based on.
Well, Colonel Glenn, a number of scientists have suggested rather strenuously that for a period of time, the likelihood is, in their opinions, that man himself does not need to be, nor does he belong in space. How do you feel about this,
well,
man
I've
himself?
Well, I've never looked at the manned or the unmanned programs as being as competitive as most people seem to think they are. I've looked at them as being complementary. I think no matter how far man goes in space, he always will still be sending out probes and unmanned vehicles ahead of him, ahead of his own explorations, to find out what is there and to be as safe in his own explorations as possible. But I think man going into this new space, this new laboratory, if you will, to conduct his own research, can learn so much more. After all, man is the only, if you want to call him an instrument, he's the only instrument that can really perceive the new and analyze it on the spot and relate it to his own existence and his own back to his own Earth as to what is useful.
Well, there was a very good example of that when the lunar module was landed by astronaut Neil Armstrong.
Yes,
he had to make a decision in a matter of 1 minute where he was going to park his vehicle. And
if this had been just an unmanned landing there and come down in the rocks that he originally was making his approach on, why, it probably would have had we don't know what might have happened.
Before we conclude this telephone conversation, Colonel Glenn, perhaps you could make a bit of a quick comparison for us between the Mercury capsule in which you made your three orbits around the Earth and the type of equipment aboard Apollo 11. Could we make this comparison that your Mercury capsule was something like the Conestoga wagons which the American pioneers dragged across the western plains?
Yeah, I think you wouldn't be too far off on that one. Of course, trying to compare two different spacecraft is a difficult thing because they're designed for different jobs. And each, of course, was on a, in its own time, was out on the cutting edge of science, or was out in the advance of what we knew how to do at that particular time. Of course, this whole and one thing leads to another. You know, it's like saying that compare one of the early automobiles and a modern Indianapolis racer or a huge truck now. There just is no comparison because they're while they are sort of sisters or brothers under the skin, nevertheless they are they're designed to do different things and designed with a different purpose. So each one of these things leads to another one, though. When Al Shepard made his suborbital flight, I build on his information for my flight, and subsequent flights after mine went into Gemini, and they build on my experience, and so on up the line. Back in those days, of course, the things that we were trying to discover were things such as, could man even operate intelligently in this new area of space, in a weightless environment? And we were interested in such what look as though very elementary things now, but in that time we were interested in such things as whether the shape of the eyeball even changes in a weightless state over a number of hours, because the base of the eye then is no longer needed to support the fluid in the eye. So the doctors wondered whether the eyeball actually changed shape. So we had a number of just similar, very elementary questions about whether man could function in that new environment of space, and what his limitations were, what his capabilities were, and also how to design spacecraft to accommodate the man. And these were the things that we were trying to answer. Once we knew those problems, or knew the answers to those things, which we did determine in Mercury, then we could go on to Gemini, in which the major objectives were long-term weightlessness of periods up to 2 weeks, and also developing the rendezvous capability for spacecraft that was necessary before we could go on to designing something like this lunar vehicle that just landed on the moon today. So each project had its own purpose and a different purpose in its own time period. So it's difficult to just go back and say compare the Mercury spacecraft with this one, because there isn't. It's a difficult thing to do. Each had its own purpose, and each was in a different time period.
And so it's all coming to fruition in just a few moments. Colonel John Glenn, we want to thank you very much for this exclusive telephone interview which you've had, you and the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, and we here in Washington. We are most grateful.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to people. I know that on this flight you're going out all over the world to many different nations and languages, and I'm just happy to participate in it and send along my best regards, and we're just looking forward to the rest of this flight being just as successful as it's been up till now, and we hope that as many people around the world as can are sharing in this with us.
Well, we suspect that they are, and we don't have to send your regards on. They've heard your voice. And again, thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye.
That was Colonel John Glenn, the first American to fly a Mercury capsule into outer space, a man who completed the three orbits on February 20, 1962. That was an exclusive telephone conversation which we had on this, the VOA coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Well, as hundreds of millions of persons on Earth follow each move, the first man in history is getting ready to step onto the moon. And in just a matter of minutes, the two American astronauts aboard Eagle, the craft resting now on the moon's Sea of Tranquility, will open the hatch. And then astronaut Neil Armstrong will back slowly down the ladder to the surface of the moon. As he leaves the craft, he's expected to activate a television camera which will record his footstep for the eyes of the world. And then, according to plan, astronaut Edwin Aldrin will join him on the moon's surface for about 2 hours and 40 minutes of extra-vehicular activity. The primary purpose, of course, to collect lunar samples to be returned to the Earth. Now we have a report from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, and VOA correspondent Rhett Turner.
12 minutes and 5 seconds from now, the hatch on the lunar module on Eagle is to be opened according to the countdown clock. And then command pilot Neil Armstrong will begin to climb outside onto what's called the front porch. The extra-vehicular activity, the period during which both Armstrong and Aldrin will go out and perform their experiments on the surface of the moon, having been moved up several hours here, 5 hours to be exact, because Armstrong and Aldrin preferred to go ahead and do it now. Dr. Charles Berry told us a little earlier that he approves of their going ahead and canceling the rest period because this is a time of day in their normal awake and sleep cycles during which they would normally be awake. It's just 8 o'clock, 21 minutes past 8 here in Houston. And the astronauts are normally just having dinner at this time, and they've tried to keep them on the same sort of work-sleep cycle in space. And they are in good shape. Dr. Berry says he has no qualm about their going ahead with the activity at this time. And then he plans to let them have a full 8 hours sleep as soon as they get back in the lunar module and close the hatch. During the last few minutes, we heard Neil Armstrong call in that he was on page 28 of his checkout list in preparing for the EVA. I've been going through a lunar surface operations plan, looking for the particular page 28 to which he referred, and it's not here. But we do know that it's one of those very meticulous planning things which the astronauts use, and which is apparently only available there in the Mission Control Center right up to the point of launch. You see, they change these things day by day as they're training and preparing for that last few minutes, up until the last few minutes before liftoff, and then nail these things down and off they go with them. There's a considerable amount of command pilot discretion on how these duties are performed. In fact, Armstrong himself made the decision to perform the extravehicular activity on the moon 5 hours early. Al?
Al is away from the microphone at the moment.
Was.
There he is.
Go ahead, Bill. You were listening. I was talking.
I'll stay with you right here. We're back and ready for them in just a few minutes. I said 13 minutes a minute ago until they opened the hatch, and now they've wiped off our clock and are preparing something else. That's to come about, 2 or 3 minutes past the half hour, the hatch opening. We're listening, standing by for any news at all from Mission Control. Everything is quiet, but the signals are locked in solid since the lunar module Eagle is sitting firmly there on the surface of the moon. If Neil Armstrong turns on his microphone, we hear it loud and clear, and so will you if they do happen to say anything. We have that circuit up, and it's very quiet, no noise on it at all. Mike Collins is behind the moon right now in Columbia. He should come around and be visible and in communication with the Earth in 17 minutes and 35 seconds from now.
Well, Rhett, a question from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has been so carefully programmed in the flight of Apollo 11. Has it also been included in the program that the astronauts, when they actually get out onto the surface of the moon, are supposed to say something, reporting, for instance, the size, the shapes, the density of the rocks, how deep the dust might be, what they are actually doing. In other words, keeping up a second-by-second vocal report of their activities.
Well, the vocal report to Earth is not as mandatory as is the timeline of their activities. The most important things are scheduled first, and the least important things, according to priorities established, are scheduled last. As to how much they care to talk and tell the Earth about it, your guess is as good as mine. They will be recording some of the descriptions of things they see, but they also have considerable photographic capability, too, for photographing samples and everything around them.
Rhett Turner, you may remember a few days before the flight began, in talking with Neil Armstrong about how he would feel when he did take that historic first step out on the moon. Here is Mission Control.
Apollo Control.
We're 60 minutes away from acquisition of Columbia on its 17th revolution of the moon. We do not at this time have a good estimate for the start of the EVA. We'll have to wait until Eagle's crew, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, give us some more information about how they're coming along in the preparations for the EVA. Indications are now that they are running on the order of 30 minutes behind the nominal time preparations timeline, maybe a little bit longer. But we'll have to wait until we hear from them again before we can get a good estimate on the time for starting the EVA.
Therefore, that explains why the countdown clock toward the depressing...
Facility base, this is Houston, over.
That call from Mission Control.
Roger, go ahead, Houston. Roger, Tranquility, we're coming up in about 6 minutes on GET of 108. If you'd like to start your event timer, we could give you a hack at 10800, over. Wilco?
That's Neil Armstrong responding with Wilco. We'll cooperate.
A check on the ground elapsed time, apparently, coming up 108 hours into the mission in about 6 minutes. If we have time right here, we'd like to play this very brief interview that we were speaking of earlier with Neil Armstrong, talking about this first step that he will be taking on the moon. Apparently, that interview is not ready yet.
It looks as though we do certainly have time. Jack Riley there, the voice of Mission Control at this point, describing the fact that they seem to be running about 30 minutes late in their preparations. Page 28 must have indicated some slower activity than we assumed earlier.
If I might interject here for just a moment, Bill, I would like to point out that we will have an announcement for VOA listeners in Europe and South Asia, and that will be relative to the frequencies on which they can hear this VOA coverage of the flight and the mission of Apollo 11. All right, for listeners in Europe, those who are now tuned to 9765 kilocycles, in 2 minutes, you should tune your radios to 3980 or 5965 kilocycles. For listeners in Europe, if you are now listening to 9765 kilocycles, please tune your radios to 3980 or 5965. Now the announcement for VOA listeners in South Asia. Those who are now listening to these frequencies, 17750 or 15290, should tune your radios to 15210.